Chief Presiding Judge, and Your Honors. Jeff Carver on behalf of the appellant, Corporal Mayor Grumato. The question may be posed as following in this case. It's whether a defendant essentially may look a gift horse in the mouth. And the appellant believes that we should be able to answer that question yes, particularly where the gift horse is a Trojan horse. A bigger, or maybe more important question is whether or not this court is going to permit the defense of self-defense to be infiltrated or diluted by allowing the government in such cases to use voluntary manslaughter as a way to dilute that defense. Now, I would like to address the points made in the respondent's brief at this juncture and make a couple of points myself. In my view, the respondent's brief is an excellent argument to justify the giving of the lesser included offense of unpremeditated murder. And in this case, the lesser included offense instruction for unpremeditated murder was given, but Corporal Mayor Grumato was not convicted of that. But this argument that the government makes is not a valid argument for giving of the lesser included offense of voluntary manslaughter. Now, I think it's important to note. I think it clearly is a less, based upon the manual. Now, there are some differences of opinion, of course, in various jurisdictions as to whether or not attempted voluntary manslaughter is even a crime, and we made that argument at the trial. But assuming it is, in fact, a lesser included offense, I think it is a lesser included offense of unpremeditated murder. So we can work our way down. He was initially charged with attempted premeditated murder. Well, arguably it is. I'd say yes. Under the type 2 version of attempted premeditated murder as set forth in the MCM, I would say that it is. It would. My position, however, is that it shouldn't have been given for two reasons. Number one, sure.
Push that button right there. Up.
Okay. Related to Judge Baker's question, you're not arguing that the appellant was not on notice of the LIO, are you?
I don't think the appellant was on notice of the LIO of attempted voluntary manslaughter. He was charged with attempted premeditated murder. Therefore, he was reasonably on notice of attempted unpremeditated murder or maybe some assault charges, but he was never on notice of attempted voluntary manslaughter, because attempted voluntary manslaughter has these two additional proof requirements, heat of passion and adequate provocation, as set forth in.
Well, it's a listed LIO in the manual, isn't it?
It is.
Are you arguing that that's not sufficient notice?
Well, I think just the fact that it is a listed LIO, when you come to voluntary manslaughter, I think voluntary manslaughter is unique. It is a listed LIO, but it is an LIO which the defendant opts to invoke, essentially. It's a peculiar crime. Some jurisdictions don't even think it's a crime, but it's a peculiar crime which is triggered by the defendant. By the defendant saying, there was either passion and adequate provocation, therefore I should be entitled to voluntary manslaughter. But if he, the defendant, has said from the moment he's approached by the government, which is the case here, Corporal Nergamato said the moment he was approached by NCIS, it was self-defense. He never once said, I was out of my head.
Well, you wouldn't disagree that, or maybe you would, that Article 119, as established by Congress, sets forth in the offense of voluntary manslaughter, right?
Definitely. It does.
And you're not, at least I would imagine that you're not suggesting that that the government is required to accept an accused statement that he was acting in self-defense.
No, they're not. But the government is obliged to tell the defendant what it is he's being prosecuted for. Put him on notice of the accusation, and that was attempted premeditated murder here. And the defense, from the defendant's own mouth and from his lawyer's own mouth through the conclusion of trial, was, well, I acted in self-defense. My defense of the attempted premeditated murder was self-defense. Now, the facts in this case and the argument posed by the government, I think, reasonably, in retrospect, justify the attempted unpremeditated murder charge and might justify other LIOs, but they do not justify attempted voluntary manslaughter, because all of the cases, certainly the cases cited by the government and the defense, are to the effect that the LIO must be supported by the evidence of record. And here, we do not have even a suggestion by the defense or the government that Corporal Nergamato acted out of some uncontrollable anger, that he was in the heat of passion, or that he was out of his mind. In fact, if you look at the government's own brief, they note accurately that Corporal Nergamato testified that he had the presence of mind to decide on the spot that he would, quote, move my rifle and shoot him in the arm. Well, but that's how the trial unfolded. We had a case where Corporal Nergamato was presented by the government as someone who had gone off and retrieved a loaded firearm, his M16, M14 action in this case, and brought it back to a fight. That was a claim of attempted premeditated murder. Corporal Nergamato says that fight erupted, and at the time I needed to act, I acted with control, with determination. I made a decision. I felt my only option was to exercise self-defense by pulling that trigger. Well, in that situation, you may have attempted unpremeditated murder, and there was some, at trial, there was some argument, discussion, evidence of on the issue of intent. Maybe it was disputed, but certainly there was no evidence whatsoever that Corporal Nergamato was responding to that kind of situation which classically gives rise to voluntary manslaughter. He didn't find Corporal Eichenberger in bed with his wife.
Now, isn't this an affray between two hot-tempered Marines?
Exactly.
Right. And doesn't that in and of itself raise at least the possibility of voluntary manslaughter? And didn't the defense at trial say this case might be attempted voluntary manslaughter, but it clearly isn't attempted premeditated murder?
You may be right. I don't remember that, to be honest.
580 in the record.
Okay, that may be right. But my recollection, having tried it, was that the thrust was always self-defense. And the fact
The thrust may have been self-defense, but that's not the question. The question is, did the judge err in doing what he did?
Well, I think when the defense particularly with respect to voluntary manslaughter, says we don't want that instruction, and we're not claiming heat of passion, and we're not going to argue heat of passion, and we're not going
to
say
provocation. Well, that gets you back to Judge Ryan's question. Does the defense have a veto on what goes on with the military judge?
Well, I think the cases do suggest that in some instances, and particularly with voluntary manslaughter, it's kind of a very unique crime, but there the defense does have the option, pursuant to Waldron, to go all or nothing, and to if you want to call it a veto, that's probably fair. You'll note in the Waldron, I think the concurring opinion of Waldron is NCMR opinion is very insightful. The court notes.
Are NCMR opinions binding on us?
Pardon?
Are NCMR opinions binding on us?
You know, yeah, but your court adopted that opinion.
In a 1-1-1 decision.
Very well, but it did. And in that case, the opinion mentioned or explains that there are instances where the defense may want to go all or nothing, and if that's the ground rules in which we entered that court-martial, which there were, we think that the rules shouldn't have changed midstream.
Counsel, is it your argument that there was no evidence of provocation or heat of passion in this case?
There was not sufficient evidence to meet the objective standard which is set forth in the MCM at paragraph 44C, 2, I believe it is.
Well, if that's the case, then it really wouldn't matter whether there were any instructions at all in this case, would it? That is, if there's insufficient evidence, the charge disappears. It had to be dismissed.
Well,
wouldn't we be here on a question of legal sufficiency at that point?
I think that's true. My reading of the record, the briefs, the present brief, especially by the government, is an attempt by the government to suggest that there was heat of passion and adequate provocation. But we can't forget the objective standard, which is set forth in the manual, and the cases, which talk about the fact that mere angry words between hot-headed Marines is insufficient, a slap or a punch is insufficient, a dispute over property is insufficient. And here, what the government has tried to do, in their own brief, is argue that, well, if we look in retrospect, we might be able to suggest there was heat of passion, and that gives rise to the necessity for giving the LIO voluntary manslaughter. But when the defendant is not claiming heat of passion as a mitigant, remember, it's always an extenuating or mitigating circumstance, one that the defense presumably is obliged to put forward. It's not up to the government. In a case where they have charged attempted premeditated murder, to then say, well, that case isn't looking as good as it did from the beginning. Now we're going to soften it and say, well, there's heat of passion here. That should not be allowed, in my opinion.
Okay. Get back to my question. Is there or is there not sufficient evidence in this case to find, as a matter of law, the offense of voluntary manslaughter?
No.
Okay. Then if that's the case, we would dismiss the really order the charge to be dismissed, not on the theory of instruction, but on the theory of insufficient evidence as a matter of law.
That's a request made in the appellate brief.
Now, if that's not the case, that is, if we determine that there is sufficient evidence under Jackson against Virginia to sustain a charge, why then would the government be deprived of the opportunity to have instruction on that matter at trial?
If there's evidence of record to substantiate it, they probably are entitled to the LIO.
So does the whole case then boil down to legal sufficiency in this case? If it's just legally sufficient evidence for voluntary manslaughter, then the government wins. If there's not legally sufficient evidence for voluntary manslaughter, then the defense wins. Is that what this whole case is about?
When it gets right down to it, I would say yes.
Thank you.
The
Just to follow up on that question, because it's not entirely clear to me whether you're arguing, first, that there is no such thing as an offense of attempted voluntary manslaughter in a case where someone has raised the issue of self-defense, or two, what the Chief Judge has suggested that your argument is that it's legally and factually insufficient in this case to sustain the conviction for attempted voluntary manslaughter, or three, whether what you're really saying is that the members erred when they decided that his claim of self-defense did not rise to the level of legal justification or excuse, but rather that it was attempted voluntary manslaughter in the heat of passion. I mean, which is your argument?
Well,
or is it all of them?
First off, I mentioned that this crime, attempted voluntary manslaughter, is unique. And there are jurisdictions, for example, Nevada, New Jersey, there have only been about 30 states that have actually addressed this, whether it's a crime, but some of those that have addressed it have come to the conclusion it's not a crime, on the theory that you can't attempt to be out of your mind. In other words, if uncontrolled activity is part and parcel of the voluntary manslaughter, you can't, pursuant to Article 80, attempt, which is a specific intent crime, you cannot specifically intend to be crazy. You can't be specifically intend to be uncontrollably angry due to added provocation. So, in their cases, the common case out of Nevada and others, which say that, so there is no such thing, it's logically inconsistent. So I mention that to emphasize the fact that although we seem to have this crime in the military, that, well, even the government's brief notes that they write on page 7 of the brief, voluntary manslaughter is a lesser offense of both premeditated murder and unpremeditated murder, agreed. But then they go on to say, in a conclusory fashion, it follows that attempted voluntary manslaughter is a lesser included offense of attempted premeditated murder. Well, I think they make that conclusory statement because, frankly, there aren't very many cases that authorize this crime. It's a unique crime. Now, we take that point and move to, well, it's unique from the standpoint that these two additional things, and this was a big point bone of contention before the lower court, heat of passion and adequate provocation, are those elements? Well, if they're elements, then it's the government's obligation to prove them, but they're not elements. The cases have pretty well come down to the conclusion that they are proof requirements of the defendant. So it's a defendant's tool. It's a defendant's option whether to offer up for the members the contention, the evidence in support of the contention, that there was heat of passion and adequate provocation. And that has to be tested by the military judge on a
do you have any case law to support the proposition that this is something that is done, that this crime is unique and is basically something that's done at the appellant's behest other than in our jurisprudence other than Waldron?
Well, there are specifically as to attempted voluntary manslaughter, I cannot think of any.
Well, the core of your argument seems to be the uniqueness of this.
It's clearly a unique crime in as much
as... Well, and I'm asking the question, is there a case law to support that proposition in our jurisprudence other than the lower court holding in Waldron?
I cannot think of any right off the top of my head.
Thank you.
Counsel, am I correct that the issue as to whether or not this was, in fact, self-defense was contested at trial, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
It was hotly contested.
Hotly.
So Waldron doesn't apply if the fact that distinguishes things are contested, right? Just answer my question first before you make your argument.
No.
Okay.
That doesn't follow.
All right. Do you agree that the military judge properly instructed on the self-defense defense?
Yes. But the fact that you have raised an affirmative defense doesn't trigger the application of LIOs. The application of instruction on LIOs is based upon disputes about the elements of the crimes charged and the LIOs. The fact that a defendant raises a self-defense doesn't ipso facto mean that that triggers the LIOs. And that's probably the main point I was trying to make at the outset, is if you allow this sort of reasoning that the government has applied to obtain, then whenever a defendant says, well, I acted in self-defense, he has this option. He either says, well, I acted in a cold-blooded, deliberate manner and shot my oppressor, in which case he's probably going to be convicted. Or he says, well, you know, in the moment when I had to decide what I was going to do, I pulled the trigger, in which case the government says, oh, well, then yeah, if he had a passion, we may not be able to convict you on premeditated murder, but we have voluntary manslaughter. And that is the problem here. There was never evidence of the passion, and there's, in my view, there's certainly not enough evidence to meet the objective standard set forth in the manual for heat of passion and provocation. This was an afterthought by the government to suggest heat of passion and provocation when it was clear that the members were not likely going to be satisfied that there was an attempted premeditated murder or attempted unpremeditated murder.
Counsel, you have the opportunity on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Captain Roger Mattioli, and I represent the United States. There's a famous quote attributed to former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt that states, "Do what you feel in your heart to be right, for you'll be criticized anyway. You'll be damned if you do, and damned if you don't." Were this court to adopt the appellant's position, military judges would be damned if they instructed members on lesser-included offenses, and damned if they did not. In furthering that argument, the government will discuss three key points. First, the charged greater offense of attempted premeditated murder has an element distinguishing it from the lesser-included offense of attempted manslaughter, premeditation. Second, even if this court compares the two lesser-included offenses in this case, as the court did in Waldron, there are disputed issues of fact that differentiate the offenses. And third, the government will discuss the absurd results of adopting appellant's position. Turning now to the first point, a lesser-included offense instruction is only proper where the charged greater offense requires the jury to find a disputed factual element which is not required for conviction on the lesser-included offense. And here, as the lower court pointed out, the charged offense was attempted premeditated murder. And the lesser-included offense, which the military judge instructed on, was attempted voluntary manslaughter. As I stated before, those offenses obviously do not have the same elements or proof requirements. Appellant concedes this in page 7 of his brief.
Counsel, the defense suggested that the offense of attempted voluntary manslaughter may not be a crime. Could you identify for us what the specific attempt is, what's being attempted in the voluntary manslaughter, and why, in your view, it's a crime?
Your Honor, in the manslaughter offense under Article 119, the statute specifically states any person who, with an intent to kill or inflict great bodily harm, unlawfully kills a human being in the heat of sudden passion caused by adequate provocation is guilty of voluntary manslaughter. So it's that intent to kill or to cause or to inflict great bodily harm.
I may not have been clear. I was referring to attempt rather than intent. That is, what is being attempted that makes it a crime?
The killing or inflicting of great bodily harm, Your Honor.
So in your view, someone who is acting in the heat of passion, has an intent to kill, has adequate provocation, but the killing does not, or the act doesn't result in death. That's the attempt.
Yes, Your Honor. In the United States,
could you then address the question of sufficiency of the evidence That is, what is the evidence of adequate provocation and heat of passion and intent to kill in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, without going through the multiple witnesses.
Right, just a quick summary, what would meet the Jackson standard on each one of those matters, intent to kill, heat of passion, adequate provocation.
Yes, Your Honor, if we're looking at the intent to kill, obviously the carrying of the loaded weapon, when the appellant carried the loaded weapon in, when he raised the loaded weapon, fired it, at the victim, Corporal Eichenberg in this case, the fact that the round struck him in the throat, the fact that there were that demonstrates an intent to kill, the fact that he brought the loaded weapon and that he then raised the loaded weapon after the fight, the struggle took place, raised the loaded weapon and fired it into the neck of Corporal Eichenberger. As far as evidence of provocation, there was Corporal Christensen, who testified that Corporal Eichenberger walked up and pushed him. It was a hard push. Corporal Muir fell down, got back up, stood there, didn't do anything, and he continues to testify about the fight, that he said a 10 to 15 second elapsed from the very beginning of this altercation to the end. Appellant himself testified as to the fight that took place, the fact that he was being thrown around the tent. He testified that he raised the rifle and his intent was to shoot the appellant in the arm, again, to inflict grievous bodily injury. And there were three or four other witnesses who were there for the altercation and also for the previous altercations, but they specifically testified that this was, in effect, a fight that escalated when the appellant raised his weapon, his muzzle, into the face of Corporal Eichenberger. That certainly gives rise to heat of passion caused by adequate provocation. It appeared from those witness testimony that the appellant was losing the fight. The defense argued at trial that this was heat of passion. They specifically say those words multiple times. If you look at the, give me just a moment to give you the sites, record at 870, this thing happened real quick in the heat of the moment, and they repeat, heat of the moment, real quick. There's simply no evidence of an intent to kill. And there was witness testimony about Corporal Eichenberger insulting, embarrassing, and striking the appellant. So those evidence reasonably raises the issue of attempted voluntary manslaughter, and therefore the military judge was required to instruct sua sponte on that offense. In United States versus Weymouth, a 1995 decision by this court stated that in no case, discussed the fact that in no case should both an offense and a lesser included offense thereof be separately charged. And certainly, the defense would object based on overcharging, possible prosecutorial misconduct, things of that nature, multiplicitousness, etc. And again, that rule, combined with the fact that this court has held that the military judge is required to instruct on any and all lesser-included offenses for which there is in the record some evidence reasonably placing the offense at issue, shows that the military judge was damned if he did not instruct on attempted voluntary manslaughter in this case. Now, appellant argues that he should be allowed to object to any lesser-included offense and, quote, require the prosecution to try him on the charges brought. Appellant seems to have backed off that argument in front of this court, but obviously that argument runs contrary to this court's case law. For example, United States versus Emmons, where this court stated that if the prosecution has met its burden of showing that an accused is guilty of some offense and the defendant has been given adequate notice that a lesser-included offense is present, the government should not be deprived of a conviction on the lesser violation. And that was this court quoting Stolarz. Additionally, in United States versus Wilson, this court held that it was not error for the military judge to, quote, refuse to allow the accused to gamble away his statutory rights. Moving to the government's second point, even if this court compares the two lesser-included offenses in this case, as the lower court did in Waldron, the disputed factual issue of heat of passion distinguishes unpremeditated murder from voluntary manslaughter. And as a preliminary matter, a look at the statutes in the United States Code shows that the statutes are not the same. Article 10 U.S.C. 918 states that unpremeditated murder is when any person who, without justification or excuse, unlawfully kills a human being when he intends to kill or inflict great bodily harm is guilty of murder. 10 U.S.C. Section 919 states that any person subject to this chapter who, with an intent to kill or inflict great bodily harm, unlawfully kills a human being in the heat of sudden passion caused by adequate provocation is guilty of voluntary manslaughter and shall be punished. So on. So therefore, you can see that those have distinct elements. However, even if this court finds that those aren't elements, the Sansoni decision dealt with disputed issues of fact, not just statutory elements. They mentioned disputed issues of fact at least twice, and certainly heat of passion and whether there's adequate provocation is a disputed issue of fact that was, as the appellant conceded, hotly contested at trial. And there are several disputed issues of fact, not just heat of passion, but premeditation, intent to kill versus intent to wound. All of that reasonably raised the attempted voluntary manslaughter instruction given by the military judge. Moving on to the government's third point. We have shown how military judges are damned if they do. For an example of how they are damned if they don't instruct, see Wells, 52 MJ 126, a 1999 case where this court reversed and remanded based on a military judge's failure to instruct on voluntary manslaughter where the charge was premeditated murder and the military judge instructed on unpremeditated murder, self-defense, and mutual combat.
Can I ask you for, I have a more constructive question to ask of you, which is when in the government's position would an accused be entitled to an all-or-nothing defense? Do you understand my question?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. And in fact, forgive me just a moment, there are a number of cases that talk about when the defense is entitled to this sort of all-or-nothing defense that appellant raises. And one of them, I believe, was Waldron itself, where the lower court said that in some cases an accused ought to be able to take his chances. And they state he should be permitted this when the evidence points to greater offenses or none at all, as was the case here. That is not the case in the case before this court. The evidence pointed to any number of charges, partially at least because of the attempted portion, because the victim did not die. So there could be a question as to whether there was an intent to wound, which is what the appellant claimed at trial, or whether there was an intent to kill, whether there was heat of passion or adequate provocation.
But that suggests that your answer is they shouldn't get the LIO when there's no evidence of the LIO.
Yes, sir.
That doesn't really answer the, I think, the underlying legal question, which is what if there is evidence of the LIO? Is the appellant ever of right allowed to go all or nothing? Do you follow?
Yes, Sean. Give me just a moment to track myself here. the only case that stands for that proposition where the defense is allowed to go all or nothing is that Waldron holding. In United States or in Stoarts, at page 493, the appellant makes that sort of same due process argument, which was rejected by that court.
What if it's a close case and it's not apparent which way it might break, but the judge, out of abundance of caution, says, I could instruct on the LIO, and both sides say no thank you. Might that be an example?
It could be, Your Honor, if both sides concede that they don't want that lesser-included defense, and they, in a sense, essence, stipulate to the fact that the issue is not raised, then it could be error. However,
why do we have to stipulate that it's not raised? If each party, for a tactical reason, wants to go all or nothing, why should the judge be required to instruct?
If both sides,
in other words, we're dealing here with a case, not here, but the let's take a hypothetical in which there is legally sufficient evidence for both the greater and the lesser offense. For tactical reasons, different tactical reasons, both parties want to go all or nothing. They don't want instruction on a lesser included offense. Why, as a matter of law, would the judge be required to instruct in that case if both parties affirmatively agree that they don't want the lesser included offense instruction?
Well, as a matter of law, it would be because of the case that I cited earlier, where the military judge is required to instruct on sua sponte on all lesser included offenses.
That's sua sponte. Which case stands for the proposition? There may be one. Which case stands for the proposition that the military judge is required to give a lesser included offense instruction over the objection of both parties?
There is none, that I'm aware of.
Would that be invited error?
That would be the second part of my argument there, Your Honor, which is that that where you have that situation, it could be invited error. And secondly, there is the case where Bartholomew, which was a 1 CMA 307, which where this court stated that if the evidence warrants conviction in a higher degree of homicide than that found, the appellant may not complain, even though the lower degree, in fact, found is not supported by the evidence. So that was a case where, similar to, I think, Waldron, where there was the defendant was convicted of involuntary manslaughter, and the court stated that there was not, similar to Duncan, excuse me, and the court found that there simply was no evidence whatsoever of heat of passion or adequate provocation, however, and therefore the members could not have found legally him guilty of involuntary manslaughter. However, since they must have found him guilty of the elements of unpremeditated murder, he could not complain because it was a lesser offense, and so therefore erred to his benefit. Also, for another example of how the military judge is damned if he does instruct, in United States versus Johnson, which is cited in Wells, this court found that the military judge erred by not instructing on the lesser included offense of voluntary manslaughter, even though the defense objected to that instruction. So perhaps that is a similar circumstance to the one that the court was asking about before. That's 23 CMA 514. And again, the Wilson case makes clear that a military judge does not err if he refuses to permit an accused to gamble away his statutory rights by objecting to a lesser-included offense, instructs, and the evidence supports his conclusion. So I apologize, Chief Judge. I think those are two cases there, actually, that do stand for that proposition that you asked about earlier. Finally, in addition to the absurd results already mentioned, if this court were to adopt appellant's argument, the practical effect, there would be several practical effects. The first would be that this court would have to overrule Emmons and Weymouth, the cases that, in essence, direct that the trial counsel or the government shall not charge each and every lesser-included offense, which is essentially what the government would be forced to do. And then this court would be faced with endless litigation on multiplicity, prosecutorial misconduct, overcharging. In effect, the appellant would be able to make his own charging decision, and the trial counsel or the government would be forced to estimate what the members in the case might think of the evidence, which certainly they're not required to do. The other practical effect would be that an instruction on the lesser-included offense of voluntary manslaughter could, in effect, never be given when unpremeditated murder is charged, since, according to appellant, they are identical under the Sansoni test. Thus, regardless of who requested the instruction, it could not be given, even if heat of passion and adequate provocation were fairly raised by the evidence. Appellant was charged with attempted premeditated murder, and Article 118 lists voluntary manslaughter as a lesser-included offense of premeditated murder. Appellant's intent was the central issue at trial, and defense offered evidence that the shooting took place in the heat of passion. Therefore, the military judge did not err in this case by instructing on the lesser-included offense of attempted voluntary manslaughter. There are no further questions. That concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, this argument of the court being damned if it doesn't, I've heard before, and certainly in every case there are difficult decisions that the military judge has to make, and if the defendant loses, there's probably going to be an appeal, but that is not a justification for turning the law upside down. There's a bias, which I mentioned in my brief, to give every lesser included offense out of caution and an abundance of caution for the defendant, and that's fine, except where, as I mentioned before, it really is a trapdoor, where it's a Trojan horse, where you're allowing the government to take the defendant's self-defense claim and emasculate it, and that's unfair. Now, the question was asked about voluntary manslaughter and unpremeditated murder in terms of are they one lesser included offense and the other vice versa. And in fact, the manual says the elements are identical, and the Duncan case at page 671 says the elements are identical. They're identical. But there's no distinction in terms of the elements. However, one is more serious than the other, and the protocol is for the judge to work down from greater to lesser and then apply which instructions have been raised by the evidence. And you don't get to voluntary manslaughter until the defendant has done that. He has brought forth evidence. I would note for the court the language in...
Are you suggesting that that voluntary manslaughter is in the nature of an affirmative defense? Because I think that that's what I hear you saying.
Well, it almost is. And then when you say in the nature of, it kind of is in the nature of an affirmative defense, because it is the defendant claiming heat of passion and adequate provocation. The government doesn't offer these mitigating, extenuating circumstances. It's the defendant. So in a sense, it is a defense. And quite frequently, a defendant will defend a murder case on the basis of provocation and extenuating circumstances act in the heat of passion, which then reduces it to voluntary manslaughter. But that is the defendant's job. So it's in the nature of a defense. Here...
Well, I didn't say it was in the nature of a defense. I asked you if that was your argument.
It is in the nature of a defense. But if the defendant doesn't opt to elect that defense, he should be permitted to do so.
How do you answer the government's contention that the defense at trial, in fact, did raise the defense by eliciting evidence as to the heat of passion, as to the argument, you know, and so forth?
Well, what they have done, in my view, is evolved time to feelings. In other words, they've transmuted heat of moment and quick into heat of passion. That's not what the law is. The fact that something occurs very quickly doesn't necessarily make it passionate or uncontrollable.
Well, if something occurred very quickly in the course of a loud argument between two men, one armed, doesn't that at least raise some evidence of the heat of passion?
Well, not according to the manual. The manual says loud arguing and words of anger, even a striking, a fight does not raise the level of heat of passion. Passion is when you see your lover in bed with another. That's what we're talking about. And the fact that you're having a fight with another doesn't necessarily equal heat of passion.
So what you're saying is the quantum of passion isn't enough.
Well, quantum is a good word because it is an objective standard. It's a question of whether the reasonable man under the circumstances would find that he was out of control, that he could not maintain his...
So what you're saying is that the evidence of a fight, of an affray, of a rather serious argument in which nasty words were thrown around doesn't fairly raise heat of passion.
Exactly. And there are a number of cases which say that.
Such as?
Well, I knew you were going to ask me that, but I think the Wells case addresses that at length. There, the defendant found his wife, Raquel Wells, with Powell. There was a shooting. The alleged lover was shooting at Wells, who shot Powell and killed him. And the court discusses all the components of voluntary manslaughter and all the things you have to meet the objective standard. And in that case, it was considered a close case where you had even the lover issue, the estranged wife issue, the fight, the shooting back and forth, etc., etc. There's an Army case where there was a shooting. I'm trying to recall the name of it. It happened in the barracks, and two gentlemen from Southeast were shooting at Southeast United States, in Kentucky, were just shooting at each other in the barracks, and they both got shot. And the court said, well, that doesn't give rise to voluntary manslaughter because although they had an ongoing fight for several hours, they'd been intoxicated, it wasn't passionate. So there are cases, but Wells, I think, has a good analysis there. In that other case, I don't think I know right off the top of it. I cannot.
Thank
the
you.
Court asked about this veto power, and I would note the language. I think it is from Waldron. Where it talks about Sansone. And Sansone is the progeny of about 100 years of criminal defense litigation, which talks about due process and the ability of a defendant to attempt to level the playing field by making choices, by making tactical, strategical choices. And one of them may be to go all or nothing. And the court in Waldron said, we take Sansone to mean that when the government has made out a compelling case, uncontroverted on the evidence, on an element required for the charged offense, but not for the lesser included offense, there is a duty on defendant to come forward with some evidence on that issue if he wishes to benefit wishes to have the benefit of a lesser included offense. This is the whole point of the defendant being in charge of his own defense and saying, I will raise voluntary manslaughter because I have evidence that I was in uncontrollable anger, acting in the heat of passion with adequate provocation, and this is how I'm going to escape the murder charge, but I understand I'm going to be convicted on the voluntary manslaughter charge. That's a choice he can make. But if, number one, he doesn't have those facts, there isn't evidence that he was out of control, and he, moreover, chooses not to adopt that defense, it seems, from my perspective, unfair to then lay that on him and say, you have to carry this burden, but you're going to have this additional offense which you're going to have to respond to. One which he didn't prepare for, was never asserted by the government, except in retrospect. And I would note that you asked Captain Mattioli about the cases. There's the Waldron case, of course, talks at great length about the all-or-nothing doctrine. But there are a number of other cases, for example, Lightfoot versus the United States, and that's cited in Waldron. There are other instances where the defendant is entitled to make a choice about how he presents his defense, and
given the fact that he, with his humble defense counsel, has to take on the government and play the government's game, it only seems fair that he should be able to decide what plays he's going to run. And in this case, Corporal Mary Romano, from before he even had counsel, said, self-defense, 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 when he talked to NCIS and the investigators. And he never said, well, you know, I was out of my mind. I was uncontrollably angry because there was all this provocation. I had been beaten. Well, no, he didn't say that. He said there had been a fight and the guy was coming at me and I had to pull the trigger and I decided, well, better his arm than his neck, but I got his neck, and that's self-defense. It's certainly not voluntary manslaughter. In our view, the court was right in giving the attempted unpremeditated murder instruction, but to keep working down the hierarchy to voluntary manslaughter when there was no heat of passion, at least not pursuant to the objective test, and no adequate provocation, I think was clearly error, and ended up in a conviction for basically a compromise verdict. And that's what all the cases argue is inappropriate. We cannot invest the jury with the ability to work out a compromise verdict out of leniency, mercy, whatever it happens to be, because that thwarts the whole fact-finding purpose of the jury and leads to all sorts of odd results, as it happened in this case, in our view. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank both counsels for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 9:55 a.m.
Court stands in recess until 09:55.